And if it makes it any better, it's kind of filled me with existential terror as well. So the topic I want to talk about today kind of came to be by, well, means of me not being able to do what I actually want to do. And what happened was that in my PhD, I've been looking at the zeta regularization of Fourier integral operators because that's really important for a lot of parts in geometric analysis. So as soon as I had some early results, I embarked on the eternal quest of finding workable examples. And that soon turned out to be forlorn hope, mainly because I don't know how to geometry. So I've been basically struggling to find examples for quite a long time. And at some point I realized, well, I know a lot more about physics than I know about geometry, and physics has the same kind of structures. So let's just give it a try and see what we end up with. I didn't really expect to get anything physically reasonable out of it because, as you will see, the construction breaks a lot of things that are physically reasonable, but I turned out to get some physically reasonable results, and I failed to find examples that I could work through that gave me physically unreasonable results. And that was kind of the point when I started sitting down with Carl, who is nicely here today as well, and we started thinking about what the heck's actually going on here. And so today I want to, well, give you an introduction to how this zeta regularization works on vacuum expectation values, how we show that this is actually physically meaningful, which happens to actually be, well, related to quantum computing. And if I have time at the end, I'll also quickly mention some things that you can do on the lattice if you want to apply these techniques there. But before we get there, let's go through the ropes, and I'm very, very well aware that I'm probably the least qualified person to talk about anything physical in this room, but there is a few things about vacuum expectation values that I want to point out because it's good to be on the same page as to what kind of questions we actually want to answer here and why we're thinking about them in that way. So let's start in 1948 when Feynman published his paper on, well, the path integral. And the picture that we basically had back in the day was a finite lattice. And, well, if you want to describe a quantum theory on there, then you go through all the paths that you can have through this lattice. You sum them up. You have a quantum mechanical amplitude for each of them. And the probability density of whatever is happening is given by the mod square of that. And so the first big contribution that Feynman gave here is based on Dirac's work, which says that, well, if you're quantizing a classical action, then the amplitude is just e to the I on h bar of the classical action along the path. And that was a big step forward because now the quantization business is essentially hidden away, and we can ask, well, what happens if I make my lattice dense? So we ask the question, make the lattice dense, then you need some continuity assumptions on the paths that you have because you're trying to sample continuous functions or functions on a dense set, and that doesn't make sense for a lot of functions unless you have certain continuity type assumptions on there, and you end up with an inductive limit procedure, which Feynman in 1948 proved to be convergent in the case of quantum mechanics. The limit is usually denoted in terms of a path integral, where, well, we replace the sum over all paths by an integral over all paths. The amplitude is still the same thing. And we write dp because mathematicians say if you have an integral, then you have to write dp. But mathematically, this expression doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. While we have ways of talking about the path space, the measure doesn't really exist in the way that we'd like it to exist. So a lot of axiomatic quantum field theory really works on the questions like, how do we define this expression? And for physics, what we usually do is either we take a case where we know what this is and do perturbation theory about that, or if we want to do it non-perturbatively, then, well, we're essentially back to the lattice and we try to extrapolate the inductive limit. So if we look at vacuum expectation values, Then in a Lorentzian background, we get expressions of this form where we have two fine little integrals that we want to evaluate and take the quotient of, but they don't make sense as a numerical problem because these only make sense in the space of distributions. If we look at the denominator, for instance, we're trying to integrate a function that is of constant modulus 1 over an unbounded domain that ain't getting you very far. So, weak rotation later, the i's turn into minus 1s, and now we're in business. But we can't always do that. There are interesting examples where I can't go into Euclidean background. So first of all, I would like to understand what this inductive limit procedure actually is doing in general. And also, if I can't perform the inductive limit, I'd also like to kind of know how to interpret this guy. And that's where we have to look at axiomatic quantum field theory for a bit, because it'll tell us what kind of structures we have to expect to see. If you assume Hadamard conditions, then essentially this allows us to abstractize the thing that we're talking about to say, well, we're working now in a separable Hilbert space, which I'm going to call curly H, and I have a C0 group, which I'm going to call my time evolution. Now, the path integral, or the propagator, will turn up as the Schwarz kernel of this time evolution, and this in general only makes sense in terms of distributions, which is consistent with the last slide where we had the vacuum expectation values that only make sense in terms of distributions. Yes?
What's a Schwarz kernel?
Essentially this expression. yeah. For all intents and purposes, take this as the definition of a Schwarz kernel. When you talk about the Hamiltonian, it's essentially defined as the generator of your time evolution group up to a factor of minus I on h bar. And if you now have an observable, call it omega, which is an operator on your Hilbert space, and you do the same steps that got us to the wonderful quotient of integrals in the discretized setting on the last slide, then we get still a quotient, but now we have the trace of time evolution acting on the observable divided by the trace of the time evolution and a thermal limit. And this expression makes sense in quantum mechanics because in the Heisenberg picture, these are just matrices. It also makes sense in a Euclidean background because these are trace class operators. That is, they have discrete spectrum and you can absolute sum the eigenvalues. In Lorentzian background, this is a unitary, which means it is bounded but non-compact, so it's certainly not trace class. And this guy is usually unbounded, so it's even worse than that. And that means the question is, what are these traces? And this is where zeta regularization really comes into play. Because we can't just construct any trace here, because we know special cases that we would like to be satisfied. If we have trace class operators, then whatever trace we construct should restrict to the trace on trace class operators, i.e. the sum of eigenvalues. If we have matrices, well, then it's just the matrix trace that we want to recover. And so rather than constructing a trace, we want to extend a trace, and that's what zeta regularization really does. So suppose you have an operator algebra. In our case, these will be algebras of Fourier integral operators, which generally contain a lot of unbounded operators. But we have a good subalgebra, which I'm going to call A sub zero, on which we know a continuous trace. In our case, this will be the intersection of the algebra with the trace class operators, and this will just be the standard trace on trace class operators. This also includes the matrix case because those are trace class as well. Now, if we have an operator A, which is in our algebra, but not in the good subalgebra, then I want to define what tau of A means. And in order to do this, I won't just consider A in isolation, but the idea is to consider a holomorphic family phi, which maps into my algebra, such that if I evaluate it in zero, I will recover the operator that I start with. Furthermore, in order to make everything work out, I will have to make sure that the construction of phi will have a set of complex numbers that is mapped into the good subalgebra, and this has to be connected and have non-empty interior. Because if I have that, then I can evaluate tau on every phi of z in this set, and this will give me a holomorphic function on this set. So if I want to say tau of A is tau of phi of 0, then I want to extend whatever tau of phi is on this set, and so I will define my zeta function to be the maximal meromorphic extension of whatever this will give me. But this means we have to answer two questions. First of all, can I evaluate in 0? I.e., do I have a holomorphic, or do I have a neighborhood of holomorphicity of 0 in zeta of phi? This will essentially give me existence of my trace extension to tau of A. And if that is the case, then what happens if I choose a different family, call it psi, that also coincides with phi and 0? Will I get the same values for my zeta functions? So these are just slightly more explicit ways of writing down existence and uniqueness of the extension of the trace. And in this generality, as I've stated it here, it can fail at any point. So there are very well-known examples where you simply cannot extend to zero. There are examples where you can extend to zero, but it depends on the choices that you make. And there are examples where you can extend to zero and it does not depend on the choices that you make. Spoiler alert, we're in a case where we're somehow in the middle. There are going to be some obstructions, but this will mean that we have to have actually a closer look at the algebras that we're working with. And before I'm going to do that, I want to give you an introductory example as to why this works or how this works. So the easiest non-trivial example that I can think of is the absolute value of the derivative on the flat torus of length 2 pi. If you take that operator, then it's fairly easy to compute its spectrum. And so if we say that the trace of the operator is supposed to be the sum of all spectral values, then I get this expression, which, well, isn't convergent. Or I can rewrite it in terms of twice the sum of natural numbers. So in order to define this trace, I want to introduce a complex parameter. For instance, I can consider the family phi of z, which is just the operator raised to the 1 plus zth power. And now, if I have real part of z less than negative 2, then this guy will become trace class because, well, these are still the eigenvalues, and for real part of z less than negative 2, that's absolutely summable. In particular, I also know what the analytic continuation of this guy is. And so if I want to extend this to 0, I can simply do this, and my zeta regularized trace of the absolute value of the derivative on the flat 2 pi torus is minus 1 over 6. So that also kind of explains why we call this zeta regularization, because those were the kind of early examples that we've seen here. Now, unfortunately, we're not working with pseudo-differential operators. If we had pseudo-differential operators, everything would be a lot easier. The operators that we're working with turn out to be integral operators on Cauchy surfaces of IR spacetime, I assume globally hyperbolic. And that means that they have a kernel, which basically says that the operator acting on a function phi evaluated at x is the integral over k of xy times phi of y dy. The kernel itself has a microlocal structure, and it can be written down in terms of this oscillatory integral, which of course only makes sense in the space of distributions in general. And it is important to note that we have a phase function which has a degree 2 part whose coefficient I call h2. There is a degree 1 part whose coefficient I call h1. And there is an amplitude which radially has a polynomial bound. Now, if my Cauchy surface happens to be compact orientable C infinity without boundary, then the trace formally evaluates as the nuclear trace, which is the integral of the diagonal of the kernel, or plugging this in, I have these kind of expressions, which are distributions that I want to regularize by throwing in a complex parameter. If you look at them, then there are essentially three places where you can put in that complex parameter. You can add it to H2, you can add it to H1, and you can add it to the amplitude. But lucky again, we know what our algebras look like, and it turns out if you change the phase functions, H2 and H1, you can always find a reparametrization of this vector bundle such that I have the same H2 and H1, and the entire complex dependence is on the amplitude. In fact, you can even assume without loss of generality that H2 is identically zero, but finding that parameterization is a pain, so I'm not doing it. I'm looking at the slightly more generalized version of it because it's usually a lot easier to work with. So, how do we throw in this complex parameter to the amplitude? And this is a process called gauging, and I'm very well aware that the terminology is horrible for a physics community because it has nothing to do with what gauging in physics means, but the terminology has been coined by geometric analysts in the 1960s, and I don't think I should be changing it now. So, when we gauge an operator for operator zeta functions, we're looking for a holomorphic family of functions g. G of 0 is supposed to be just the constant 1 because we want to recover the point, the operator that we started with. Furthermore, I assume that for every z, I am radially homogeneous of degree z, and then I have some holomorphic map in the sections of the sphere bundle. This is essentially your freedom to play with in order to make things workable if you actually try to do computations. And there are easy examples where you can choose this function well and make things really easy for yourself, and where you can choose it poorly and you don't stand a chance to ever compute anything. But because our amplitude has a polynomial bound radially, if the real part of z is sufficiently negative, this will counterbalance the polynomial growth of your amplitude, which means if I multiply the amplitude by this gauge function, then for real part of z sufficiently negative, this will become a well-defined integral, and that turns out to define a trace class operator, which means that the trace of phi, which is now the integral over k of z along the diagonal, which is this integral, makes sense for real part of z sufficiently negative. And we have to ask, well, how can we extend this analytically? That happens to be a lot of work, but luckily that's what I've done in my PhD. Yes?
I know you told me this, but can we go back one slide?
Sure.
I know you probably have a bunch of time, so. Can you repeat what the significance of that integral is? What where that came from?
This?
Yeah, like the expression that you're regulating.
That is the trace of your operator as a distribution.
Right, and why does it take that form again?
Because the Hadamard condition implies that you have a Fourier integral operator, which you can write down as an integral operator with a kernel of this form, and integral operators have something called the nuclear trace, which is precisely this guy. And the nuclear trace coincides with the normal trace on trace class operators.
So is it fair to say that expression you've written there is the path integral, but like in like it's basically the path integral.
Yeah.
And but it's restricted and with like if you apply the postulates of if you apply results from AQFT, I don't know, then the path integral also take that form.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So if you regulate that, you regulate the path integral.
Yeah.
Okay, I think I got that.
So yeah, how do we extend this guy? Well, as I've said earlier, you can actually always assume that H2 is zero, but slightly more generally, if H2 vanishes on the diagonal, then you have a standard Fourier integral operator zeta function, which is, well, the topic of my PhD. So we have a fairly good understanding of what this guy looks like. And they extend, they may have poles, which will give some problems later on, but generally speaking, we have a handle on this guy. If H2 does not have zeros on the diagonal, then about 3 to 4 pages of calculation later, you can show that this actually has a holomorphic extension to the entirety of the complex plane. So in either case, up to the special cases that come from the Fourier integral operator zeta function, yes, we do extend to zero, and it only depends on the value of phi of zero. So we have existence and uniqueness. If we really care about this being a trace, yep, it's also a trace. So we can define the traces that we had on the last slide of the vacuum expectation values chapter precisely as this zeta function evaluated in zero. And that means that the fractions that we want to consider make sense in this meaning, where we now have to talk about what are the critical cases that come in from the Fourier integral operator zeta function. Well, if our zeta function has a pole, then it turns out it has to be simple. So we can only ever be in the residue divided by residue case, which is fine because the residues actually are traces as well. They're a continuous trace, and that makes sense. If you're in the, well, zeta function evaluated at zero divided by zeta function evaluated at zero case, then this trace is called the generalized Concevich-Visek trace, and it too is independent of the choices that you make, so everything's peachy. If you are in the zero divided by zero case, however, then you are taking higher order Laurent coefficients or the quotients of thereof, and they do depend on the choice of gauge that you do. So while formally you can choose different gauge functions in numerator and denominator, you can do this unless you are in the zero and zero case, in which case I want to argue from physics to write down the following definition. Take your favorite quantum field theory, construct a gauged family of operators, which I call capital G, such that G of zero is just the identity, and the kernel of U times G of Z is precisely of the form that we've just talked about. You can always do that. So all I've done here is essentially shifted the point of view from the symbolic side to the operator side. And then what I can do formally is I can say, well, this may now be a family of time evolutions of some other quantum field theory. Now, physically, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense because this is not a C0 semigroup. But if I take this point of view, then for real part of Z sufficiently negative, those quantum field theories will have well-defined vacuum expectation values following Feynman's construction. So following Feynman's construction, you get the trace of those guys in the denominator, and in the numerator, well, you take the time evolution, you plug in your observable, so that fixes the choice of gauge and means that you have to choose the same gauge, both in numerator and denominator. If you can show that you're not in the zero and zero case, feel free to swap this out, but this looks like the physically reasonable choice to me. So, here we have a mathematically well-defined definition of something that, well, can be applied to physics, but why is that anyhow reasonable? So, let's have a look at some examples. The first example that I want to look at is a free relativistic fermion in 3 plus 1 dimensions. The Hamiltonian is this guy, which you're probably all well familiar with. And on the symbolic side, this guy looks like this. The gauge that I choose is incredibly inspiring. It's just r to the z. And if I now want to, say, compute the ground state energy, then my observable is the Hamiltonian itself, and I plug everything into my expression. Does anyone know what the result of this should be? I like asking this question to mathematicians, which is always quite funny because they come up with really interesting answers. But
for example?
Oh, very fun ones. I'm not spoiling anything here. Does anybody have an idea? Well, let's find out, shall we? The first thing that we're going to notice is that the first term in the numerator and the denominator are exactly the same up to your factor of mc squared. So splitting up the numerator into two quotients and quotienting out everything that's there leaves us with an mc squared. And this term back here, where I've also integrated out the psi dependence because there's no psi dependence in the integral. Now, looking at this guy, you might remember that a couple of slides ago, I said that these guys always are of the form e to some phase function. Well, we can make this happen by replacing the sine and the cosine, which means we have now this expression here. And if you stare at this long enough, you will realize that these are analytic continuations of Laplace transforms of homogeneous distributions. Well, we know exactly what the Laplace transform of a homogeneous distribution is. It's a homogeneous distribution. And you can even look that up on Wikipedia. This is the Laplace transform analytically continued. So now we plug in the limit z to zero. That gives us some coefficient, and a t to the minus 4 divided by t to the minus 3. Whatever this thing is, it's proportional to 1 over t. We're taking the limit t to infinity, and we've just computed e is equal to mc squared.
It's a funny mix of all the distributional theory, but also c is still there.
It's a physical expectation. It's probably the most complicated way to compute this.
Probably. But I think that's a funny little example.
Actually, can we go back on our slide?
Sure.
Okay. Actually, I don't really understand where the integrand came from in the first place.
It's you take your Hamiltonian, you compute the time evolution by solving the wave equation.
Wait, why are you solving a wave equation?
Because I'm essentially it's e to the ith.
Okay, so it's the matrix exponential.
Yeah.
It's an evolution operator of that Hamiltonian.
Yeah, times the Hamiltonian, and then you plug in the gauge.
You put in
exactly.
You
exactly.
Okay, fair
enough. And then you go through this. And the important thing of this is that other than it being a funny example, it actually shows us explicitly how the zeta regularization works. Namely, by means of analytically continued Laplace transforms. And this is something that even my computer can do, if you give it enough input. So let's have a look at this fun little example. It's a topological rotor. It's a particle of mass m on a circle of radius r. The generalized coordinate that I'm going to choose will be the angle. Introducing the moment of inertia, you can write down the generalized momentum, and the Hamiltonian is something that even I can compute. Then an interesting observable would be the topological charge, i.e. the winding number of the path of the particle in the interval 0 to t. Well, actually, this is not really interesting because due to symmetry, that's 0. But the variance of this guy divided by minus it in the limit t to infinity for reasons that I don't understand, but physics textbooks keep telling me, is the topological susceptibility. And I can implement this using SymPy. So it's actually a fairly short program. You define your symbols, you define your gauge and the Hamiltonian and the observable. I'm using r to the power z again as my gauge. Then I write down the numerator, the denominator. If you're wondering why the heck am I writing down Fourier transforms, I'm also evaluating them in zero. So this is just a fancy redescription of integrate, forcing it to use a different library than it would use if I just wrote integrate. And then I take my limit by taking the numerator divided by, well, it minus it times the denominator, limit z to 0, limit t to infinity. And as you can already see here, this is interesting because if up to a factor of 2 pi squared, this will give me the energy gap. So if I run this and I go back, then my prediction, which I took shamelessly from physics textbooks, is that this should be 1 over 2j. And I'm pretty sure it should be done by now. Yep, 1 over 2j. So that worked out fine. Another example, which is a little longer as you can see, but also interesting, is spontaneous symmetry breaking. So let's take scalar fields phi1 through phi k, Hamiltonian that depends on them, and a partition function which I can define using this zeta regularization again. Yes?
The expression q looked like it should be real, or is it imaginary? Because you divided it by it and got...
It is imaginary because I use imaginary time evolution. So I'm using e to the I t Hamiltonian, not e to the minus t Hamiltonian.
So it's sort of it's just there from the way you...
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I'm using essentially the Lorentzian background. So again, I can now define my partition function using the zeta regularization scheme. And I can also say, well, this is just my partition function with respect to some effective potential. Now, I'm looking for constant local minimizers of the effective potential, which means I'm going to solve this guy for the effective potential, which is fine as well. And this is interesting because in the limit t to infinity, those guys will give me my vacuum expectation values of the fields. And the Hessian of the effective potential has, well, eigenvalues, which in the limit t to infinity will be my squared field masses. The easiest non-trivial example that I could find is phi to the 4. So that's the Hamiltonian, which I, again, copied out of a physics textbook. And it also told me that the vacuum expectation value should be plus minus square root 6 over lambda times mu, and the field mass should be square root 2 times mu. Now, the important thing here is that because I used the zeta regularization to define the partition function, the partition function is independent of the choice of gauge, which means the effective potential is independent of the choice of gauge. So this either works in every case or it fails horribly in every case. And unless my computer is letting me down, we have minus square root 6 divided by square root lambda times mu plus square root 6 square root lambda times mu and field mass square root 2 times mu. So, woohoo!
Isn't that just the classical value?
Yeah.
But I thought this was supposed to compute the ratio of path integrals.
Well, if you compute the ratio of path integrals, you can do that too.
I'm sorry?
But you can rewrite this if you write down it as an observable. But you can do that. This is just an example for me to use the regularization because in this partition function doesn't make sense analytically unless I do the zeta regularization.
This is indeed an outstanding example that you take the full quantum field theory.
Yeah.
This is phi to the 4, right? This we have not done yet.
No, of course. The full phi to the 4 theory is something that we're trying to make work. So what we've seen here are a few examples, but then again, I wouldn't be showing you examples unless they worked, right? So why does that make sense in general? And this is something that Carl and I have been looking at for the last little over a year. And there is a paper in the archive which says that if your quantum field theory is sufficiently nice, and I'm going to say a little bit about what that means in a few minutes, then there exists a discretization scheme, actually infinitely many, such that taking the continuum limit of this discretization scheme will converge to a definition of vacuum expectation value, which people in axiomatic quantum field theory really like because it's easy to define, but it's effectively useless for all intents and purposes because you never know the vacuum. And on the other hand, it converges to the zeta regularized vacuum expectation, which means in particular that the zeta regularized version is physical in this sense. And this is a way of understanding what this expression means and how to compute it, because for the zeta regularization, you don't actually need explicitly knowing the vacuum. So, furthermore, this discretization scheme is accessible on a quantum computer, so if you can, you do. And an example that we looked at is a one-dimensional hydrogen atom. We chose the one-dimensional hydrogen atom because it is highly non-trivial in the discretization scheme that we're using. This is actually of maximal difficulty for a quantum computer with a given number of qubits. And still, if I look at the ground state approximation in the number of qubits, I obtain exponential convergence, which is something that we didn't expect to happen. We've also run this on the actual hardware. In this case, we've run it on a Rigetti-Sagave chip. Obviously, we didn't go to 11 qubits because the chip doesn't have 11 qubits, but also because the error just blows up due to noise. So what we have is on 2 qubits, we already had a roughly 100% error, but on 1 qubit, that result we could reproduce to about 15% on an average performing qubit and 5% error on the best performing qubit. We've also rerun this on the new Aspen chip that Rigetti has, and there we got down to 0.5% in January.
What did you run? I'm a little bit more
sure here. For instance, the 1 qubit approximation of the...
So how did you compute the ground state? Like, I mean, of course, you could just write down the formula. And
that's
the
computer, right? Next slide.
My calculator can do that.
Yeah. next slide.
Okay, sure.
I'm going to tell you how exactly we've done this. And this is really the question, how do we discretize for the proof of that or physicality of the zeta regularization. So how do we discretize? We start with a Hilbert space H, and we're looking for an orthonormal basis, which I'm calling EJ. You can't just take any orthonormal basis that you would like to see here, because you also want to find a densely embedded Hilbert space that contains this basis as well, such that your gauges acting on the observable and the gauges themselves are bounded linear operators from H1 to H, at least for all z in some open neighborhood of the half space containing zero. There are more assumptions on H1, but in the end, what this boils down to is H is unitarily equivalent to an L2 space, H1 is unitarily equivalent to some Sobolev space with sufficiently many derivatives. So you can always make this happen. Then, once you have H and, well, your basis in H1, we're going to have to project down to a finite dimensional subspace in order to discretize. So the finite dimensional subspaces that we're looking at are the linear spans of the first n basis vectors. And that means we have a projector Pn in H and Qn in H1 onto the subspace. And this automatically gives us the discretization scheme. If I have an observable, then the discretized observable is just conjugated with these projectors. Because this is true for the Hamiltonian as well, the time evolution takes this slightly nasty form, but that's the one that you get. And the discretized vacuum will be defined as the minimizer of the quadratic form with the discretized Hamiltonian in this n-dimensional subspace, where obviously the states are supposed to be normalized. And this is something that we solved on the quantum machine. You can do this, for instance, using a variational quantum eigensolver. Now, we've done this by brute force and full state search, but we didn't really want to make this as an example of quantum computing and being fancy there. That's something that we're working on at the moment. We just wanted to show that this is actually doable on a quantum machine.
Is there actually a quantum speed up in finding eigenvalues of a matrix? I mean, you could, if I understand correctly, at the end of the day, you have a matrix and you find its eigenvalues, right? Like that's.
It depends on the operators that you're looking at.
But, I mean, that is what you're solving, the problem you're solving.
Yeah.
You have a concrete matrix and you're finding.
Yeah.
So you could have done that on any computer.
Of course. I mean, everything that you can do on a quantum computer, you can do on any computer because
sure.
you can simulate it.
Like if you had like a if you had like a stable quantum computer that was really big, would it be
yeah.
better doing this?
It depends on your Hamiltonian.
Okay.
There are cases where this will be exponentially hard. There are cases where it's going to be polynomially. It really depends on how you're doing this. But the important thing is that n grows exponentially in the number of qubits. So if you do this on a classical machine, it's always exponentially. Whereas on a quantum computer, like we are currently looking at the Heisenberg model, there this goes cubically
so
in the number of qubits.
Aside from like a dense matrix on a quantum
yeah.
computer, essentially.
Yeah. So with this discretization scheme, we can now start talking about why this actually works. And if our quantum field theory has a mass gap and the vacuum is non-degenerate in the continuum, then we can prove that up to accounting for a phase factor, these discretized vacua will converge to the continuum vacuum. And if you now also say that your observable has bounded variance, then this means that your discretized vacuum expectation values of your observable will converge to the quantum field, axiomatic quantum field theory definition of a vacuum expectation value. So this really is a discretization scheme with the proper continuum limit in the sense that we'd like to see. On the zeta side, we're going to slightly swap point of view. Rather than looking at the gauge being part of the time evolution, we're now putting it into the observable. So for a real part of z sufficiently small, we're looking at ug omega divided by ug, which in the discretized setting is just these two traces. But we can also write this down as a quotient of vacuum expectation values of two different observables. And this is now a holomorphic function. So we have a sequence of holomorphic functions, which turns out to be compactly convergent. And because for a real part of z sufficiently negative, this side will pointwise converge to our definition of the zeta regularized vacuum expectation. This family is compactly convergent to the zeta terms. And that's important because compact convergence implies pointwise convergence. So if I evaluate this expression here in zero, I don't only get that the discretized vacuum expectation values converge to the axiomatic quantum field theory definition, but because g of zero is the identity, I can formally write it in this way, which gives me the zeta definition of it, and therefore I also have convergence to the zeta regularized vacuum expectation. So this actually does make sense for some reason. Now, in the last few minutes that I have, how can we do this on the lattice? Well, on the lattice, we're back in this discretized picture. And we wanted to understand quotients of integrals of this form. And so usually what we do is we weak rotate and we get quotients of integrals of this form, which we can evaluate numerically. But I'd rather work with this guy because I can't always do this weak rotation. So a zeta lattice QFT would start in exactly the same way that you would start your lattice QFT, and you write down your numerator and your denominator. Now, because you can't actually evaluate this guy on a computer, you add in your gauge, which means this function a is now dependent on a complex parameter, which means that, yeah, simplest case, you might call this norm p to the power z times a, or whatever else feels really nice and makes your computation easier. Then you actually have to do a bit of work, and this is not particularly difficult in the sense that you need to be really, really clever in figuring out how to do this, but you actually have to sit down and not make mistakes. And that is you need to construct a family of Fourier integral operators whose traces are distributionally equivalent to whatever this guy is. Sounds intimidating, but it's relatively straightforward once you know what you're trying to do. And once that is the case, you end up with an expression which is a series over some index set, and then, well, integrals over some spheres, a radial integral, and the kernel or the symbols will look like this. And again, we are in this setting that we had earlier. These alphas don't depend on the radial coordinate. So we can pull this out of the radial integral, and we're left with analytic continuations of Laplace transforms. So if physics is nice and the space function theta that you just saw doesn't have any zeros, then you can, again, take the analytic continuation and just plug things in. Every case that I've seen so far is of this form, but I have no reason to suspect that this is generally always the case. But now that we have this case, we can take the limit z to 0, and we're left with a series over some index set, some gamma terms, and integrals of continuous functions over spheres. So while we started out with an expression that was numerically ill-defined because we were trying to evaluate non-integrable functions and integrate them, now we have an expression which is numerically well-posed. This is just a continuous function on a compact set that you're trying to integrate. In general, this will still be really, really difficult, no question about it, but in my opinion, really difficult is a whole lot better than impossible. So what if you're not in this case? Well, if you're not in this case, then you actually have to look at the zeta functions themselves, and that means you have to look at the Laurent coefficients that you get. And those are they. If you are in the pole case, you're still pretty, you're actually very lucky, because in that case, you only have the what's called critical degrees of homogeneity that are left over, and the Laurent coefficients are generally a finite sum over integrals of spheres over, well, continuous functions. So again, perfectly doable. If you have to work with higher order Laurent coefficients, then things get a little more nasty, but what do we have here? Well, we have a principal value integral of a continuous function on a ball. That's doable. We have a bunch of sums and integrals over spheres with integrants being continuous functions. That's still fine. And more continuous functions integrated over spheres. So again, even though this looks a whole lot worse, it is doable. And with that, let's recap what have we got. Well, we now have a mathematically rigorous continuum formulation for vacuum expectation values with Lorentzian background that does not require you to actually know what the vacuum is in the first place. We have proven this, and we can apply the same setting for lattice QFT with Lorentzian backgrounds. Furthermore, in the proof, we've introduced a discretization scheme which allows us to be accessible on a quantum device, and that means we can, well, look into quantum computation, which is something that we're actually doing with Carl at the moment. On the other hand, what do we need? Well, of course we need better quantum processing units, mainly because there's still a lot of noise and we'd like to have more qubits, but generally speaking, I'm not too worried about this part, because if we look at the last year, for instance, in August, we had a best error of 5% on noise, that is down by an order of magnitude with one generation of quantum devices later. I don't suspect that this is going to be the bottleneck long term. The other thing that we need are better algorithms. The algorithms that we've used are entirely trivial. There is nothing ingenious about them. They're really, really just brute forcing in order to get our results. And generally speaking, quantum algorithms are not straightforward to implement, at least not for me. So I would really like to have nicer algorithms that are more stable, that I can use without having to think as much about as I have to do at the moment. Also, when we're talking about the zeta lattice QFT, then this can be done on classical machines, but this means that we have to do integration on high-dimensional spheres. So if you think about lattice QCD, what are we currently using? Some 64 cubed times 92 times 12 dimensions or something like this? That's roughly speaking the order of magnitude of the dimension of the sphere as well. It's not going to be exactly the same. That depends a little bit on your problem, because there are certain dimensions that can be integrated out in the construction of the Fourier integral operator traces and this kind of stuff. And if you are unlucky and you don't know how to do your simplex homomorphisms, then you might get a whole lot more dimensions out of it. But generally speaking, I would expect the dimension of these spheres to be at the same dimension that the lattice QFT would be if you could do it Euclidean. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
So is there, so I understand that like once you pose this way to compute like analytically rigorously these quantities in one of the theories, you've done like sanity checks with things that have been computed by less rigorous means.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that you've computed that is that what we didn't know how to compute before? By the less?
Well, the one-dimensional hydrogen atom, for instance, hasn't been done, to my knowledge, in the way that we set it up. But that's mainly because we constructed it in such a way that we get an example that is highly non-trivial for the application. The other examples that I've looked at, no, I've basically did sanity checks, because these computations, while the free relativistic fermion is fairly straightforward, but everything else does become rather involved rather quickly. And especially if you want to go to curved spacetimes where you are at no shortage, then the computations become really, really difficult, and you actually need to do some geometry there as well, and that's something that I can't do. But it's certainly possible to think of examples that are probably solvable, which I haven't done.
Okay, so my, you can correct me if I'm wrong, my very naive physicist understanding of zeta function regularization is that when you write down these zeta functions, you say if you have like a differential here in the differential operator case, you have some, you wind up with some poles, which are effectively encoding something about the divergences of your theory.
Yeah.
You can write them as, there's some sort of local expressions that you can think of as like the counter terms that you want to subtract.
Yeah.
And the zeta function is a very clever way of just sort of going around the poles and never picking up those contributions and just sort of zooming in on the origin or wherever you Okay. It seems like you've generalized this beyond the case of local operators. Really, you're doing this on the true Hamiltonian of your system. So very high dimensional. Is there anything in that case that you can say about where the poles should show up, what kind of divergence structure you have, or is it, I mean, you said there are different, okay, you said there are some different cases, but at some point in the differential operator case, you had some additional knowledge about your operator, you sort of knew the degree of divergence, you knew where the poles were gonna show up, and you knew.
Yes, that essentially boils down to the construction of the operators. If you can construct the log homogeneity structure of your operator, then you can write down these terms as well. So they're implicitly contained in here, and they will show up in the Laurent coefficients. And these are precisely what analysts call the critical degrees. If you have the time to write down your theory in this precise setting, and you can locate the critical degrees, then you can extract this explicitly. Doing that for an interesting physical theory is a different question. But yes, the information is strictly there. It's just a question of, can we get there? And if you think about looking at this in terms of some other scheme, then you can also consider differences, and you might be actually able to get the asymptotics of differences in an easier way than the actual asymptotics that you're working with, and then back engineer what the divergences had to be in the first place. But this is highly non-trivial, and there is no generic way of thinking about this. It's like, yeah, this is essentially what people do when they're doing like wave invariance and something like this. They're really trying to precisely get these coefficients for the divergences.
Right, I guess the Euclidean version of that is like the heap kernel. Or
yeah, something. Exactly.
Is there anything like a heap kernel version of your story?
Yes, it's the wave invariance, essentially. So you do the same. You do the same thing as when you're looking at the heat expansion. Then for the heat kernel, you would basically get the pole in zero and nowhere else. In this case, you will get poles in the length spectrum of your Cauchy surface, and the coefficients, the residues around there and the coefficients of the Lorentz expansion around these poles will give you topological information in the same way that the heat kernel has the information in the pole going to zero. Yeah.
So suppose you solved all your algorithmic problems and your quantum computers were working perfectly. So like, what capability would you have that you couldn't do by like more like mundane modest discretization?
Well, I could, for instance, get approximations of the vacuum for condensed matter, which I've been told by people from condensed matter is something that they'd be interested in.
So you could. I see. So it's because it's regularized already. You don't.
Yes.
Yeah. So you don't have to figure out like what terms of subtraction you're taking.
Exactly.
So that's actually. I see. Okay. I
mean, you could stay in the Minkowski metric. Could have chemical.
That
potential.
Too.
Yeah. Okay. I missed that. I just hadn't appreciated that last point. That's fair enough. Yeah.
You can consider real-time processes. These kind of things.
So what is your feeling? I mean, one assumption of this theorem is that we have a mass gap.
Mm-hmm.
This is a mathematical assumption.
Yes.
So would this work for conformal field theories?
So the assumption of the mass gap is something that I need for the proof in order to exclude a case which technically I could see happening, but then again, I don't think it actually does ever happen in any meaningful way, because what I'm trying to exclude is the case where the vacuum where the discretized vacuum give me a sequence which are mutually orthogonal for every n. That will not be convergent to the true vacuum because it's weakly convergent to zero, but not convergent at all. But given that we have to pick up non-trivial parts of the vacuum in order to have the energy minimized anyway, I don't think that this actually is a real problem, but I don't know how to get rid of this assumption mathematically.
So